The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In June of 1944, shortly after the Allies landed at Normandy, the International Red Cross visited a ghetto and concentration camp in what was then Czechoslovakia, a camp called Terezín. The delegation was shown a carefully crafted lie, a Nazi-created diorama showing prisoners treated in relative comfort, the streets lined with fresh plantings and newly painted homes. A ghetto, but one which encouraged and supported a rich cultural life, complete with a performance venue and newly created works of classical music. Some 30,000 Jews died at Terezín under horrible conditions masked by the Nazis during that Red Cross visit. Many thousands more were sent to the gas chambers at Auschwitz. And while few of the residents of Terezín would survive the Holocaust, their voices, their plays and poems and operas created and performed there live on. The Voices of Terezín is a series of performances and lectures and films that's running all month at Keene State College. Among those speaking, Mark Ludwig. He's a scholar on music and the Holocaust and a member of the Boston Symphony Orchestra, also executive director and founder of the Terezín Music Foundation. And Mark, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
So that piece we were just listening to, it was made to accompany a German propaganda film. Can you describe the scene that it accompanied?
Well, it's a work by Pavel Haas, who before the war was considered one of the prize pupils of Leos Janáček. So this is one of the up-and-coming major figures on the classical music scene. He wrote what was called The Study for String Orchestra. Just to clarify, he wrote that just as a composer, not just for the film. In fact, the Nazis co-opted that piece, among others, for use in the propaganda film. And when you look at the fragments that have survived of that propaganda film and listen to the narration, it cuts into a narration saying basically the work of a Jewish musician, of a Jewish composer, is being performed in Theresienstadt. And you see the musicians, you see audience members, and of course, this was nothing like the reality of being a prisoner in Terezín. And they perform this piece, and there's a little snippet, and then they show the composer taking a bow. And of course, months later, on the final series of transports to Auschwitz, Pavel Haas, with many of the musicians that appeared in that propaganda film, went directly to the gas chambers.
So what was the Nazi agenda in showing this flourishing, creative community at Terezín?
Well, look into context of World War II, where things were going. Clearly, the war was going in the favor of the Allies, and now this was basically a way to dispel word of the final solution and the deprivation and death that it was occurring in the concentration camps. So this was, in a sense, the paradise ghetto. And it was used as a propaganda vehicle, not only just as a film, but they also prepared for a Red Cross International Committee visit.
This visit, like Pyongyang today, there are sometimes international monitors that go in. Terezín was designed to create this kind of illusion of relative prosperity. But what were conditions really like there?
Well, imagine a garrison town before World War II. That had approximately a population of 7,500 people. And as a concentration camp, Terezín actually had a peak prison population of over 63,000, all in the same facilities. These were not expanded facilities. You're looking at an environment of deep deprivation, starvation, lack of adequate medical care. The fact that over 30,000 people in that concentration camp alone died. And then on top of that, the existence of uncertainty, not knowing when one or one's loved ones would be placed on a transport to the East.
Prisoners there published a magazine, they wrote poetry, their children's drawings. There was even a jazz band called the Ghetto Swingers. So were prisoners forced to create works by the Nazis, or were these just expressions made in response to the horror of the camps?
No, actually, I will give you another way to look at it, which is very inspiring to us. Imagine people who are sent on a transport, and you have to think in the context of what was life like for Jews in throughout occupied Europe. And under the Nuremberg racial laws, for example, Jews were no longer allowed to own musical instruments. And there's a whole list of horrible restrictions, but I'm just going to focus on that for a moment. So you're no longer allowed to own an instrument, and yet there were people who kept them and then smuggled them into the camp at great peril, great risk. So imagine, how would you, for example, smuggle a cello in? And there's one story where the instrument was cut into pieces and put into the lining of several coats, brought into the camp, and then glued back together. So initially, performances that were given in the barracks, these were really, you know, ad hoc performances, were done in a secretive manner in the attics and basements of the barracks. And when they were discovered by the Nazis initially saw this as an effective means of keeping the population, the prison population, under control. So there was always the threat of revoking the privileges, so to speak, of cultural activities. Then over time, the Nazis co-opted it and forced the prisoners to participate in really the propaganda projects of, well, what we just spoke about, the propaganda film, and of course the International Red Cross visits.
Let's hear something else composed while at Terezin. This is Brundibar. It's a children's opera composed by Hans Krause, which was performed more than 50 times at Terezin. So let's hear a clip from, this is a 2007 recording from Act 1, Scene 1, performed by the Orchestra Giovanili Gams Ensemble. And during those many performances, who was in the audience? Was it the Nazis?
No, you know, just to backtrack a moment, that piece which was originally composed for a Jewish orphanage in Prague, almost all those children, as well as the composer, were sent to Terezin. What the composer Hans Krause did, he actually put together a new score, if you will, for whatever instruments were available in the camp. This was done initially for the children. You have to think about the power of culture, what the role it played in this camp. So throughout my research over the years, I would actually look through some of the medical records. You'll find that the more you know about Terezin, it's quite a surrealistic place, in that here you had some of the greatest creative and scientific minds of Europe imprisoned in this camp, all because they were Jewish. And in a camp of great deprivation and horrible medical facilities, juxtapose that with having some of the greatest scientific and medical minds of Europe. So they're faced with, of all things, early on when the prisoners are coming in, a high suicide rate. And what was the means in which to try to stem that rate? It was cultural activity, engaging the prisoners either to participate in or experience readings, songs. So the power of music was just an amazing vehicle. So now think about the children. The children, as Jewish children, they're prohibited by the Nazis to be educated. So secretly, these children had to be educated in the camps, and also they had to be engaged. You had to engage their minds. Brundibar is one of those unbelievable stories where the children were so engaged. There's a slight change in the ending of this Brundibar in the libretto, where the children sing, you know, we sang our song, we won the victory over the tyrant mean. So Brundibar, the arch villain, really becomes so metaphoric for Hitler. And here are these children singing this. And when you look at this film clip, it breaks your heart, because as you're looking at these children who are singing, and then the camera pans into the audience filled with children, you realize that after the production of this film, most of those children went into the gas chambers of Auschwitz.
We're speaking with Mark Ludwig. He's a scholar on music and the Holocaust and a member of the Boston Symphony Orchestra and executive director and founder of the Terezin Music Foundation. He's going to be lecturing on December 1st at Kane State College as part of the Voices of Terezin series. Well, Mark, you researched this work, you performed this work. What does that feel like, you know, seeing these works recreated, even performing them yourselves, when you know the story behind them?
Well, I take a real pride in the fact, and I feel really blessed that, one, I have had the opportunity to research and be part of recovering this musical legacy. But for me, what has become so important beyond my passion for this music is looking at the history of what did the arts mean to the children and the adults, how it helped them to cope and survive, and the messages that they give us, and show us just how important culture is in our lives today. And not only in enriching our lives, but to challenge us. I mean, needless to say, we're living in very challenging times. And in this case, art is not frivolous. Art is not just pure entertainment. Art is there to challenge. Art is there to transform and to inspire. You know, when you think back, like we talked about Pavel Haas, and I mentioned to you a few minutes ago, here was this, you know, up-and-coming composer. He was really the successor to Leos Janacek. And you could say that about several other composers who were incarcerated in Terezin. Could you imagine if they had lived another 30, 40 years, not only the music they would have composed, but the next generation or two of composers and artists and the people that they could have inspired and influenced. So we're, in a sense, we're trying to graft their legacy onto to our tree, if you will, of cultural activity and creativity.
You will be speaking on December the 1st about the legacy of one particular composer and conductor, Victor Ullmann. One of his final works, The Emperor of Atlantis, or Death Abdicates, which was never performed at the camp. Let's hear just a clip of a recent 1994 recording of Ullmann's The Emperor of Atlantis. This is conducted by Holderlin Lieder. Mark, nearly all of the artists, poets, and musicians at Terezin, including Ullmann, were sent to the gas chambers at Auschwitz. How is it that so much of their works created there were preserved?
Well, in the case of Ullmann, here was a man that just before going on the transport to Auschwitz was convinced by a friend to leave his manuscripts. So could you imagine if he had decided, which would have been quite natural, to have taken it with him, they would have been lost. So we're quite fortunate that a lot of these works were left in Terezin by the composers. And then you have a body of their music that was composed before the war. Some of it survived, and then, of course, some of it has been lost.
For Ullmann, though, the time at Terezin was perhaps his most prolific period. So what does this story of Terezin tell us about art and the human condition and the persistence of that creative spirit?
I think it, on one level, just shows us how vital culture is for all of us as human beings. You know, if you think in the context of trying to place yourself in the shoes of somebody being sent on a transport to Terezin, where you're allowed to bring only up to, say, if you can, 100 pounds of goods, whatever you can carry, all right? So what would you, just put yourself in that position for a moment. You would probably take some food, you would certainly take clothing, but then you see that people smuggle in instruments. All right, they bring in music, they bring in art supplies. that it shows culture is just so important and vital to their survival, just as important as breathing, eating, sleeping, that, you know, without that, there is no hope.
Mark Ludwig, a scholar on music and the Holocaust, member of the BSO, and executive director and founder of the Terezin Music Foundation, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Mark is going to be lecturing at Keene State College as part of their commemorative series, The Voices of Terezin, on December the 1st. There's also a film screening and a panel discussion that very evening, and you can find a full list of the upcoming events at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before it was embraced by celebrities, chefs, and an estimated 16 million Americans, veganism meant radicalism, like the animal rights activists who throw red paint on women wearing fur, a tactic picked up by the Sex and the City movie.
Fur is murder!
A number of vegans have labored to distance themselves from that image, setting off a schism that has divided the movement for 15 years. One camp follows an all-or-nothing imperative to eliminate the commodification and consumption of animals and animal products. The other is working to make strategic, incremental changes in food policy, production, and preferences. Chase Purdy is a New York-based journalist who writes about food for Quartz. That's where we found his article about the divergent paths of the vegan movement. And Chase, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So a shift within the vegan movement started stirring in 2000, then this split in 2001. What was behind it?
So what was really behind that was for at least three decades, the vegan movement really sort of was one note in many respects. People who drove this movement had a very sort of specific ideology that it was either, you know, it was a black and white, either no animal products or animal products. People need to make a choice, and it was a moral imperative to choose living life without these animal products. And about seven people in 2000 basically thought that they could accomplish more by approaching this differently. And so it started with them. They were mostly in Washington, D.C. They were all friends, and they decided to approach the vegan movement with the idea that they would be able to accomplish more by driving for incremental change.
And incremental change meaning what?
Meaning that, well, for starters, that instead of focusing on so many different areas in veganism, like the fur fashion industry and how animals were used in labs, they would focus on one thing, farm animal welfare. The idea behind that was that most animals in the United States are part of the farm animal system. And so by driving for policy changes at the state and federal level, that they would be able to do the most good for the most animals.
By getting people to eat less meat?
That's part of the strategy, yes. You know, there are a few examples of this that come to mind, and that is in 2008, there was a ballot measure in California that was going to basically change the requirements that egg farmers had for the sizes of their cages. That measure passed in California with overwhelming support. In February of 2014, the Humane Society, which is a major player in this effort, partnered with the United Egg Producers to try and put in the U.S. Farm Bill a provision that would also tackle some requirements for cage sizes for laying hens. That, fortunately for them, didn't really work. It got torpedoed by other interests at play. But it's another example, this time on the federal policy level, like how they're driving for change, they're trying to make lives better for laying hens. And then we saw it this year in November when in Massachusetts, another ballot initiative passed, again with overwhelming support, 78%, to create a requirement that any egg, pork, chicken, poultry of any kind sold in the state, that those animals had to housing arrangements that allowed them to stand up, turn around, stretch their wings, move more freely. And that passed. That got support. So you can really see over the last, like, since 2008 all the way through this year, just a massive amount of effort being put towards changing policies.
You follow the trajectory of this small clan of pragmatists, some of them working on changing policies. You just talked about lobbying policy, making inroads with investment banks, undercover investigations, and also founding a well-known eggless condiments company. So a number of different strategies. How is this pragmatic side of the vegan movement doing compared to the more, let's say, absolutists?
Right. So the interesting thing about this handful of people who really dug in 2000 and drove this movement is that you can really track the changes that they've been able to make as they've gone through this past 16 years. One of them just this year founded a lobbying institute in Washington, D.C. that represents the interests of sort of plant-based and meat alternative food products. Another one helps mastermind writing these ballot initiatives that are being put in front of voters across the country. Another one is talking to major investment banks here in New York, Morgan Stanley, ING, BlackRock, and trying to sort of convince people in the investment community and the finance community to care about animal welfare from a very sort of pragmatic financial perspective. Another one of them has gone on to really dig in and do sort of undercover investigations so that, in her view, that people know how animals are being treated on this farm level. And then, as you mentioned, yeah, that one of them has gone on to found Hampton Creek, which is a very well-known eggless condiments company. They have a product called Just Mayo that has gotten some notoriety through the years.
We're talking about a definitive split in the vegan movement that happened right at the beginning of this century and created two very divergent paths forward. Chase Purdy is with us. He's a New York-based journalist who writes about food for quartz. I want to pick up on this idea of the Massachusetts ballot initiative because, you know, it just happened. 78% of the voters, as you said, supported that prohibition. Now, I imagine the kind of, you know, agitating that can be done by lobbyists or in back rooms. But that means the support of a number of voters, we're assuming a lot of them non-vegans. How did they pull that off?
Right. So a major part of the strategy for, you know, this sort of pragmatic vein of the movement is really appealing to people's sort of everyday sensibilities, in a lot of ways sort of the emotional side of how our food is produced in this country. That includes issues like, should piglets have their tails cut off without anesthesia, or should an egg-laying hen or a pregnant pig, a sow, be crammed into a cage where they can barely move? And, you know, what I have learned from the people who are driving this movement and what they say that they are hearing is that, you know, by and large, people don't want to be eating food that comes at the expense of animal suffering. And at least in the Massachusetts example, 78% of the voters on Election Day supported that ballot measure. So they seem to be able to really be convincing people that this is the future, that there will be specific standards for the husbandry practices from where their food comes from.
Well, that's also Massachusetts, you know, a notably liberal state. And if we can divide, you know, food production in the Midwest, in Texas, in California, there are these huge farms and the scale is so much bigger than places like Massachusetts. What difference does a small state like that actually make in egg production, for example?
So that's sort of what makes this ballot effort so interesting on the part of the Humane Society, is that they have really found a way to change the system without appealing directly to the food companies that are responsible for producing a lot of the food that's in this country. They have figured out that if they can go into urban areas and appeal to a great number of people, they can basically change the food system from outside the heartland where food is made. So, for instance, in Massachusetts, there are about 6.7 million people in Massachusetts. There aren't a lot of egg farms. But if Massachusetts residents are willing to support a measure that says we're not going to buy eggs or pork or chicken that came from animals that couldn't be caged, then a farmer out in Iowa really has to make a decision. if I want to tap into that huge market on the East Coast, then I'm going to have to change my practices here in Middle America. And that's sort of really that's the tactic that's being used here. And for now, it appears to be working.
Chase, this pragmatic model that was kind of championed by these seven dissidents from the vegan movement, lobbying, corporate culture, you know, investment, working on ballot initiatives, that's a pretty high bar for a lot of activist movements. Do you think it's something that is replicable?
So I think that the answer to that question really is sort of left to be seen here. It was actually kind of interesting that as I was finishing up this story that it kind of coincided with the election, and, you know, just it's, you see it on social media, you hear it on the streets. There are a lot of people in this country that are talking about how they can create change, how they can start movements, and it would not surprise me if there are lessons to be learned in this specific movement story, in the vegan movement story. Is it perfectly replicable? Probably not, but it certainly is proof that in many cases, striving strategically for incremental change in the right zones can be a very effective method to spark change and to gather a following along with it.
How about that popular image of vegans throwing red paint or chaining themselves to farm posts? Is that outdated?
So that's sort of beyond my scope of expertise in this area, for sure. I think that those movements definitely have played a role in drawing attention to an issue. I think a lot of those people who do prescribe to those methods have a really deeply held conviction for why they are doing that. In terms of whether or not that drives the most actual change, I think that that's sort of what's debatable here. And I think that sort of this pragmatic movement within veganism shows, or at least offers a pretty compelling example, that there is a better way to approach people. One of those pragmatists that I talked to, her name was Mayun Park, you know, she used to be in that movement. She was one of those people, and she told me that she used to lock herself to anything and everything she could, that she screamed like I wouldn't believe, that she even got arrested so many times. And she said she loved it, and she misses it because there's nothing like feeling that you're 100% right. But then she sort of added that when she looks back now, she feels like she sort of messed up because she thinks of all the people that she maybe turned away by acting like that. And I think that that is an interesting point that she makes. And I think that serves kind of as an example that perhaps that absolutist movement isn't going to serve or make the most change, even if it is drawing attention.
Chase Purdy, he's a New York-based journalist who writes about food for quartz. Thank you for speaking with us.
No, thanks for having me.
You can read his article about the two divergent vegan movements. There's a link at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Baseball is America's symbolic pastime, but football wins with the fans. 112 million people gathered to watch last year's Super Bowl. That's more than twice the number tuning in to see the Cubs win the World Series. Still, it's a slight dip from Super Bowl 2014's ratings, and that slip has continued this season in a big way. There are no shortage of theories as to why, from election coverage to the NFL's tarnished record on player safety and conduct. And then there's this.
There are a lot of things that are going on that are unjust, people aren't being held accountable for, and that's something that needs to change. That's something that, you know, this country stands for freedom, liberty, justice for all. And it's not happening for all right now.
That's NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick on why he won't stand for the national anthem. Bob Ryan is a longtime sports writer who shared his 10 theories why NFL TV ratings are down in the Boston Globe. Bob, great to have you on Word of Mouth.
Well, nice to be here with you. Thank you.
So how far down are the ratings?
10% seemed to be the generally accepted, give or take, ballpark figure that they were using. 10% is a significant amount of people in any circumstance. Ratings-wise, we're talking about many millions of people. That had to be very alarming to the network and to the league. But in the week 10, NFL dignifies itself in that manner. Things turned around in a somewhat dramatic way for reasons that we can only guess at. It was the first post-election week, and so if anyone thinks that there was a connection, that the country was, dare I say, distracted by the business of state as opposed to the deadly serious business of sport, then this was the first post-election return to normalcy, borrowing a political phrase from long ago. And that's possibly part of the reason. I think there were good matchups, and it turned out there were compelling games, because with ratings, people don't know before a game starts that it's going to be compelling. But it was the best weekend of the season for the NFL, there's no question.
Well, we're not going to hit all of your theories, which you did not put in, let's say, order of importance. But certainly one of them, the Kaepernick effect. Do we have real numbers on people refusing to watch because of his symbolic protest?
Not that I know of. I do not know if anyone has actually conducted a professional poll to try to determine the extent of his effect. So I don't know. It's only anecdotal, strictly word of mouth. We know it's out there.
Well, so one player has such a powerful effect. So what's underlying this, Bob?
He tweaked the nose of people who feel that they are patriotic and who feel that America has been unduly maligned by him in this regard. That I can't speak for all of them. Obviously, I think there's always an element of racism. As recently as this week, I received a thoroughly racist letter saying that the real reason people aren't watching is that the white population doesn't want to watch these black guys. This was post with no name, of course, no return address, but it was postmarked Corpus Christi, Texas, in case anybody's wondering. And we know that's out there. That's out there. That's never going to go away in our society. So, but I discount that as a reason why people are, in general terms, aren't watching either baseball or football, either football or basketball. But in any way, the Kaepernick thing had to do with people feel that he maligned the military, that he maligned the soldiers, that he maligned patriots all over. That's what they feel, and so they turned on him and supposedly absented himself from watching games as a result.
Well, there's also, of course, a frustration about the game and the league itself. It ain't what it used to be. You know, too many flags, too much passing.
Mm-hmm.
Others, you cite about changing viewing habits of NFL fans. So what's shaking up there?
I think that's the number one reason. If I were to rank them in order of importance, just on everything that I'm assimilating, all the reading and listening I'm doing, they're the millennials. Specifically, but I mean maybe not exclusively, are changing their viewing habits to the extent of getting away from conventional television, cutting the cord is the phrase, getting rid of a cable and then eventually maybe even TVs in favor of having the things streamed to them and sent to them in a different manner, in the palm of their hand, on a pad, and on an iPhone, whatever. And I find this just counterproductive, obviously. I give me the biggest screen I can find, not the smallest, but that's the way they want to live. Fine. And also, there's another phenomenon known as the red zone, and the red zone in which you just see the highlights as teams get inside the 20-yard line, one after the other, after the other, after the other, at the expense of watching a full game. You get to see the climax of plays, of drives, rather than the whole drive. Some people are very content with that, and I would not be, and I don't have the red zone, and I've never sat and watched it. I've only seen it in passing in public forums, you know, restaurants and bars, etc. When I looked up, and there it was. But apparently, this is a very popular way for people to spend their Sunday afternoon.
How about the NFL? Are they doing anything to address this? Is cord cutters, maybe fewer commercials, maybe shorter games, consistent real consequences for domestic abusers, perhaps?
Mentioned commercials, and I must point out that I did not cite commercials specifically, and that I was bombarded. First of all, I got the most response to anything I've written in a couple of years with this. Number two, I was stunned, and my wife said I was naive. I should have foreseen this. I did not mention commercials because I don't care about commercials, because I'll explain why. But people do care, and people feel that that's the number, and that was the number one reason cited for me. Overwhelmingly, too many commercials, too long. And specifically, there's a sequence of events in which a team scores a touchdown, there's a commercial, there's an extra point, and there's a commercial. That one drives them crazy.
Mm.
They feel abused. And I just find it amusing, because we're talking about a 10% reduction in viewership from this between 2015 and 16. Those commercials were there in 15. I just don't know what all of a sudden people decided that they've reached some Popeye state. It's all I can stands. I can't stands no more kind of thing. Is that what I don't know what it is that is the tipping point that has sent them over the edge in 2016 as opposed to 2015? If commercials are the complaint, because I don't think it's any different this year than it was last year. But people are complaining about commercials, and the NFL this week, post-election week, they did address this topic and said that they're going to discuss this with the network, and perhaps they will reduce that specific commercial.
So looks like a number of contributing factors, but numbers are up post-election. So what do you think here, Bob? Is this a perfect storm or a continuing trend?
We're going to see. I can't wait to the week two post-election, because week one was dramatically better. But as I say, it was a compelling set of games. I am not normally a person who sits and goes wall-to-wall on Sunday from 1 o'clock when the first game appears until the end of the Sunday night game. I don't usually do that. But I chose to do that last Sunday because it was an attractive slate and was rewarded, as were all football fans, with excellent games. So Atlanta and Philadelphia, excellent game. Pittsburgh and Dallas may go down as the game of the year. 7 lead changes. You don't see that in football. And then the climax by the Patriots in Seattle, reenactment of Super Bowl 49, which turned out to be a go down to the end of the game, which was another back and forth game that was very compelling. And you can't produce those kind of games on demand, and whether they're going to have a similarly fortunate slate of games in the second week after the election, we will see.
Bob Ryan, an award-winning sports writer and columnist emeritus for the Boston Globe. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're entirely welcome.
You can find a link to read his 10 theories why NFL TV ratings are down at wordofmouthradio.org. We just got the big national picture of trends in football ratings and viewing, but we're curious to know if local football fanatics have changed their viewing habits. So producer Jimmy Gutierrez went to a sports bar in Concord, New Hampshire, during last night's game between the Patriots and the 49ers, which, by the way, is Colin Kaepernick's team, and produced this audio postcard.
I watch it every Sunday, every Monday, and every Thursday.
I think soccer is coming to the USA big time. And that's why football's down.
There's so many commercials. So you got timeout commercial, you got a field goal commercial, then you have a kickoff commercial.
And I don't know what they're saying, but I'm a Patriot fan, die hard, and will always be one.
I don't care about Colin Kaepernick. And giving him any attention is exactly what he wants.
The concussion stuff, that bothers me. But at the same time, I really enjoy watching football, hanging out with these guys, you know, and women, you know, and having a drink.
There's so much more, many more effective ways of accomplishing the goals that you're trying to achieve than a silliness on the football field.
I guess you could say that we're part of the problem with, like, if we stop watching the football, then maybe the concussion thing would be better, but I don't know.
Oversaturated the market, that's it. Well, and the whole protest thing doesn't help. The kneeling for the national anthem. And Roger Goodell's an idiot. That pretty much sums it up, I think.
We have the best quarterback, and we also have one of the best coaches. They will go down in history, and we're going to the Super Bowl, no doubt in my mind. Go Pats!
An audio postcard there from the draft in Concord, New Hampshire, produced by Jimmy Gutierrez. The voices you heard belong to Sandy Paul, Chip Sullivan, Dave Palizzi, Joel Yetton, Derek Peterson, and Jay Schweimer. I'm Virginia Prescott. We are on the gratitude buildup this week, so doubly thankful that you could spend a little time with us today. Music in this episode came to us from David Seste, Franco Luzzi, and Broke for Free. We'll be back tomorrow with more Word of Mouth at 2 here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue,
Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire
Public Radio.